Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a doctor good? We all want somebody who is well-qualified, and we want a doctor who cares about patients' well-being and the ethical practice of medicine. But the fact is that understanding of medical ethics has changed over time, so that what might have been understood as an act of mercy a few decades ago could be construed as inexcusable today. My guest today had this reality driven home to him when he went through the journals of his father, a devoted infectious disease specialist who made enormous personal sacrifices for his patients, but also took enormous liberties in deciding how they should be treated. Baron H. Lerner is a bioethicist, historian of medicine, and an internist himself. His latest book is The Good Doctor, A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Baron, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you grew up hearing from many people in your life about what a wonderful doctor your father was. Can you talk about what made friends and colleagues and patients admire his work so much?
Well, he was sort of, I guess we'd call now, a 24/7 doctor. He spent a huge amount of time at the hospital, was often there every day of the week. When anyone, friends or family, got sick, he was the go-to person. He sometimes took care of them himself, but other times would refer them to another doctor or make sure they got into the hospital. So he was just seen as someone who is incredibly reliable and cared deeply about not only his patients, but his friends and family who needed a doctor.
And it seems like he valued that sense that he was important in their lives and could do something good for the people who relied on him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he... I mean, part of what I talk about in the book is the reasons he became a doctor, and he very much saw it as a calling and was grateful to his family for the sacrifices that they had made in order to get him to become a doctor and get an education. So he wanted to give back, and so he saw that very much as part of his whole persona of someone who was both a doctor, but also someone, a doctor to his patients, but also in a sense, almost a doctor to the community.
Hmm. What do you remember about your own observations of seeing your father at work when you were young?
Well, I remember him, and a lot of these memories are from when he used to bring me to the hospital. I think it was more common in those days, doctors would bring their kids and plop them down in the nurse's station. And I just remember how much everyone revered him. It was Dr. Lerner, Dr. Lerner. And he was always being paged overhead. And as a young kid, I certainly found it to be very exciting. And he clearly was well-respected and was doing good things for people. So it was pretty heady. It was certainly part of the reason I think I became a doctor myself.
So you had an interest not only in the science of medicine, but also in medical history and medical ethics. Can you talk a little bit about how those three things came together for you?
Well, I was certainly interested in the medical aspect, as I said, sort of having seen my dad work as a doctor, and then the notion of taking care of patients myself was appealing. But I also had a different part of my brain that was active. I was always very into history. So it was my favorite subject in high school, and then when I went to college, I was a history major. And long story short, I realized that there was an area of medicine that I could pursue that would allow me to enable me to keep studying history, which was the history of medicine. So as early as medical school, even as I was completing the medical requirements, I started doing some history projects, and that led to bioethics because the years in which I was in medical school was the beginnings of bioethics, this movement that questioned a lot of what doctors had done and was known for a bunch of different scandals. So it was sort of a natural progression for me as someone who was interested in history to look at some of the ethical problems that had occurred historically within medicine.
And some of those problems included things that you were to discover that your father had done.
Yes. So one of the things, I mean, I knew about some of these things, but when reading his journals, I learned about more of them. For example, my dad participated in what is called human experimentation without informed consent. So I think the most famous example of that everybody talks about is the Tuskegee scandal, where doctors didn't treat men with African-American men who had syphilis. But my dad, in a lower-level type of instance, did some experiments at an institution for disabled, mentally disabled children where they were injecting antibiotics into them and measuring their blood levels and seeing how the antibiotics were metabolized. And they didn't get formal consent for that. So this was, ironically, this was one of the exact sorts of transgressions that I had begun to study as a historian and an ethicist. And here it was in the pages of my dad's journals.
How do you square that with this person who raised you and who cared about you and who you know to be a decent human being? And then you look at this and then it has to have been, and there are a number of stories here, but some of these discoveries have to have been sort of shattering for you, at least initially.
Yeah, they were. It's been an interesting process for me. So some of them were oh my God moments almost. Certainly that one was, and then some of the other incidents that occurred in hospitals where he's participated, where I almost had to catch my breath and say, "Oh my God, how could he have done this?" But the thing about being a historian is that the main rule of being a historian is to try to look at what happened in historical context.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're trying to do is not look back from our modern perspective and evaluate, but to try to understand how people at a particular place and time chose to make decisions and why they did what they did. So once I put my historian hat back on, I could begin to understand why some of the things my dad had participated in made sense, at least to him at the time.
So the book starts with a pretty jarring story of your father physically interfering with hospital staffers trying to revive a patient that he did not think should be resuscitated, did not think this patient would return to any sort of meaningful quality of life. Can you tell us essentially what happened there?
Yeah, this was I guess we call it a humdinger. This story was of all the ones that I think made me catch my breath, this may have been the most dramatic. So to make a very complicated case reasonably quick, this was a woman, and the important point is she was incredibly sick and in incredible suffering. She had very, very bad arthritis and vascular disease to the point where she was bedbound for years, and in this particular instance had been in the hospital for months. And there's quotes that my dad talks about that he wrote at the time describing how she was so gravely ill and swollen, and her skin was falling off, and she was in pain every day. And I'm just conveying the point that this was not a woman who was going to get better.
Mm-hmm.
She was dying, and she was getting worse and worse. And one morning, my dad was an infectious disease doctor, so they were on rounds on her every day mostly because she kept getting so many infections, and she had just died. And her heart was not beating, but her skin was still warm. And my dad said, "Do not dare resuscitate this woman. It would be inhumane and cruel, and it's not appropriate." But she did not have a formal order written in her chart that you needed saying do not resuscitate. So when my dad and his ID doc, the other ID doctors, left the floor, someone got cold feet and called a code. And then my dad came back to the room and did what you said, which is he physically placed his body on top of the patient and prevented his colleagues from trying to resuscitate her because he thought overwhelmingly it was the right thing to do. Even though most people at the time, from a legal and ethical perspective, would not have done that and would have objected.
I mean, on the face of it, Baron, it sounds so disturbing that someone could be in a hospital and have this happen. On the other hand, I think if one could put in that woman's place a loved one who had been suffering for a long time, things get much murkier. And I mean, we understand why you can't allow this to go on. And yet everybody wants to hope that maybe an exception would be made in a particular case with someone they cared about.
That's the problem in a nutshell. I mean, that's what makes it complicated, but also so interesting. And that's very true. You try to set up, when I'm wearing my ethicist hat, you try to set up rules that allow the right thing to happen. So you've got to put rules in place. There have to be teams. You have to have discussions in advance. And you try to do the right thing. But every now and again, you encounter a case where the rules don't seem to be working. And then the question is, what do you do as a doctor? And do you just go along and shrug your shoulders and say, I really wish this wasn't the case? And I know that in many cases that happens because I've seen it with my own eyes and I've seen it myself. Or do you do, in this case, what my dad did, which was to say, you know, to hell with the rules. I know this patient better than anyone, and he did. And I am going to do the thing that a doctor should do in this case. And I'm not going to let this woman have any more pain and suffering. And I'm not going to let her spend her last few days, if she somehow gets resuscitated, in an ICU on a machine with 1,000 tubes. I can't let it happen. And that's why he did what he did.
It strikes me reading this book that physicians today have more power in terms of technology and medical knowledge that's available to them, more power and in some ways less power than they've ever had before.
Yeah, it is an interesting paradox. We can do so much, and there's so many invasive procedures and so many tests we can order, and there's so much knowledge that we have in one sense. And in another sense, I think our hands are tied at some point by the regulations and by the rules. And, you know, as I've been going around talking about this book, I've gotten so many stories from people telling me who had been in young doctors in ICUs that very day, saying, I can't believe, like, the stories you're telling from 30 years ago. It's in my ICU today. We have a patient with X, Y, and Z who shouldn't be there, who's suffering, and we can't get her out of the ICU, and we can't get the family to understand, and we're doing things we don't think we should do, and it's so sad and so frustrating. So in high-tech medicine, and these are the smartest doctors at wonderful institutions, and I don't mean to put all the burden on patients and families, by the way. You know, sometimes the medical conditions themselves are so complicated and difficult that you want to try to do everything you can, and then it turns out things don't work.
And then the moment that you sort of declare a rule or a policy for a given situation to ensure that everyone is treated humanely and ethically, the next situation that arises is just different enough that it's not a perfect fit.
Exactly. It's something I think we struggle with all the time. And as you know, as you were saying before, Chris, the question is, do you make an exception? And ethicists, there's a term that is always used in bioethics for good and for bad called the slippery slope.
Sure.
And so that's what gets talked about all the time. It's, okay, you know, you make an exception in one case, but then you're going to make another exception, and then you slide down the slope, and what's the point of having rules anyway? And nobody really likes that analogy because it's sort of used too much, but there's still some relevance, and I think we struggle with it on a daily basis.
Are we too afraid of the slippery slope?
My dad would have said so. That it's not a term he used particularly, but he felt to some degree that what had happened in medicine was that doctors weren't willing to stand up to the system anymore, and that they knew what the right thing to do was, but they were either afraid to do it or they felt their hands were tied. And, you know, someone who read the story of my dad placing his body over the patient that day used the word courageous in describing it to me. And they said, your dad was courageous. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but in a sense he was. He said, I'm going to just do the right thing in my mind, and there may be ramifications, but I've got to just do it. This is why I became a doctor.
Baron H. Lerner is my guest. He's a bioethicist, historian of medicine, and an internist. His new book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with bioethicist, internist, and historian of medicine, Baron H. Lerner. His new book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. You can be part of the conversation now by calling our open lines at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Baron, one of the other things that your father did, not once, but really time and time again, was care for members of your immediate family, and not in the sense that he would call in a prescription if they had an earache, but really manage their care in a very meaningful way.
Yes. My dad got very involved in the care of several of his relatives toward the end of their lives. It was very much a piece of the sort of doctor he was, because he felt that as a physician, he could be very helpful to people who were in great need. He knew that he could work the system for them. He knew he could get them medications if they needed them. He knew he would see them every day in the hospital, and their doctors might not be as attentive. So he got very engaged in their cases. Unfortunately, I had to conclude in some of these instances he sort of crossed the line. He got too over-involved, and he had too much of a conflict of interest between being, on the one hand, their relative, and on the other hand, their doctor.
People who don't have a doctor in the family, you know, might wonder why it's such an issue if it's not a question of sort of going into surgery with someone. But I guess one of the concerns is that if a close relative is caring for your case, you might be reluctant to say ask for a second opinion.
Right. There's all sorts of caveats. One, you might not want to get a second opinion. Two, it would be extremely hard, for example, for the patient to say no to the doctor/relative. It's hard enough to say no to a doctor. And certainly the decisions that you would try to make for the person as a doctor are going to be colored by the fact that you've known that person for so long, that you know their family, that they know your family. It's sort of a big can of worms, and they're not surprisingly, there's all the, like the AMA and all these other organizations have come out with statements really discouraging this sort of thing from happening.
In the case of his own mother at the end of her life, he knew or felt that he knew what she was most afraid of.
I can corroborate some of this. This was my grandmother, my dad's mother, and her sister had had a stroke years before and was miserable afterwards. She was debilitated and unhappy, and so my grandmother, Pearl, she always talked about the last thing in the world she wanted was a stroke. She didn't want to be dependent on anyone, and ironically, as it turned out, she had a hemorrhagic stroke, so a very bad stroke. She was in her late 80s. And my dad had been involved in her care all along. He was managing her blood pressure pills. He was visiting her all the time. And so when she got into the hospital with this very bad bleed and she was in a coma and she was never going to get better, my dad felt that it was time to take some actions that other doctors would not really have done.
And what did he do?
Well, I never got the story entirely completely, and I read his journals, and it's a little murky, but clearly my grandmother got a lot of morphine. Now, morphine is a handy drug that's used in a lot of situations, including easing breathing and easing the pain of people who are severely ill, and sometimes when that happens, people stop breathing. In this case, though, I think the morphine was turned up in a way that it was just going to help my grandmother to stop breathing and get her out of her suffering and the condition that she had so dreaded being in.
There are people, I think, we've had discussions on this show about people who wish that they were in a position to spare their loved ones suffering at the end of their lives, but, you know, most people can't do anything about it. Of course, it's illegal. What do you do with this when you learn about this and at least what appears to be the case from looking over the records and looking at these journals? It appears that your father, it wasn't even assisted suicide, right? It was a kind of euthanasia.
Right. I mean, you know, I didn't formally term it euthanasia in the book because I don't know all the details. Mm-hmm. And giving her some morphine would have been appropriate. I think it may have been the amount of morphine that she got. It's very hard to process. It's again one of those cases where maybe in an individual case you could say that this given the severity of the situation and her previously stated wishes, you could potentially understand this sort of thing. But again, most patients don't have doctor relatives, and most patients don't have doctor relatives who would be willing to do this thing, and there's a reason for that. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a reason that there are stipulations about how much morphine you can use and how it should be used. It was very common at one point for doctors to give large doses of morphine to try to ease the suffering of people, but it was too close to euthanasia for our society, and as a result, there are now rules in hospitals saying, you have to give smaller amounts, and you have to document it, and you have to do another examination. So, I can say, though, as my grandmother's grandson, that she would have fully supported what he did. Mm-hmm. If you could have magically made her appear and asked her, she would have said, "This is what my son, the doctor, should have done. It was time for my life to end." But having said that, it's very hard to try to entirely accept this because it's just something that a whole system has emerged to try to prevent. It's just not something that should be any sort of a rule in our society, which has argued appropriately, I think, that doctors should not be in the business of euthanasia.
How did we decide that, though, Baron? How did the field of medical ethics decide that it is, and maybe this is not where the basis of the decision lies, but that it is more cruel or wrong to practice euthanasia than it is to keep someone in like a persistent vegetative state?
Well, it's a long history. I think my understanding, the main aspect of this has come from both doctors themselves and people looking at doctors saying that doctors are in the business of curing people and doing no harm. And once you cross the line into an active intervention that speeds death, that's not what doctors should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you could, and look, where there's other countries where this, for example, Belgium, there's other countries in the Netherlands where there's less strict rules, and they're struggling with these sorts of issues exactly. And where do you draw the line, and is it more humane to do this? I will say that, the technologies now exist in the pain medications to make most people pretty comfortable. I mean, I don't think there's huge numbers of people who are in so much agony that can't be treated these days. So if you're fortunate enough to be in hospice or have a good palliative care team around you, most people using morphine and other drugs can be made comfortable enough that you don't have to even entertain this issue of speeding things. So it's a complicated issue, and our society has decided, America has decided, we're drawing the line between making someone comfortable and speeding their death. And there just one other thing, there are now several states that allow physician-assisted suicide, which is something in the middle where doctors can give patients pills in advance that they can take at some point in the future. So that's, again, part of the negotiating process.
Another interesting, I think, assumption that a lot of people make is that if anyone gets to this state, they would want to die quickly. But in fact, that's not the case for every patient. And as your father got sicker, he was interested in more and more aggressive interventions.
Well, this is, life's complicated, right? Here's a really good example. So here's my dad. So for years and years, it becomes, as his career goes on, I mean, he starts out as a young infectious disease doctor treating infections and curing people. And more as time goes on, as more patients, the population ages and he sees more elderly patients and he sees more demented patients and more technologies being used, he winds up seeing patient after patient who basically he feels like he's prolonging their death. They get infection after infection. They come in the hospital, they go out of the hospital, they come back. And so he becomes a very strong advocate, as has been suggested here, of not prolonging the lives of people whose lives seem to be so poor and full of suffering. So my dad got Parkinson's disease at the end of his life and did okay for a while and gradually deteriorated. And in 2011, we finally had to put him into a nursing home because he was very groggy and he couldn't move around at all and he was too much work. And we had, as a family, to confront the issue of what was going to happen if and when my dad deteriorated and got sick. So I went to him and sat down with him and had the discussion with him about how aggressive we should be. That was when the surprise happened. So I was expecting him, having talked about this for years, to say, "Oh, don't you dare give me antibiotics.
Right.
Don't you dare take me back to a hospital." But he, at least in that state, agreed to potentially going back to a hospital and even going on a breathing machine if he thought it would be temporary and we could get him off of it. So he sort of threw a curveball right toward the end of his life.
Did that frustrate you, knowing at that point, because you were aware at that point of some of the decisions he'd made on behalf of other people?
Oh, I was well aware. And yeah, I don't know that I was frustrated. I was surprised, and it reminded me what a complicated area we were in, because of all people who should have given me a definitive answer in the other direction, it should have been him. So I had to... It's a bit of an existential crisis, and certainly people in the field of ethics have written about this. What do you do when someone appears to change their life, their mind at their end of their life? And it's not that common, but we definitely see it, where someone sometimes has a living will or a healthcare proxy that says, "Leave me alone. If I get sick, if I'm so ill, I'm not enjoying my life." And then when push comes to shove, they're willing to have these aggressive things. And all of a sudden, there was my dad. He was that exact person. So it was a very tough decision for me, my mother, sister, and the rest of our family.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Amy in Ennis. Hello, Amy.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for this great show, and I cannot wait to read the book. I am a hospice social worker, and what I find way too often is that physicians are resistant to making that referral, having that conversation with the family about hospice, about end-of-life care, about palliative care. And we do education after education about how it's more effective the longer we have access to the patient. The number one thing we hear from families and patients is, "We wish we had you sooner." Yet we still have this resistance on the side of the medical professionals to utilize, palliative and hospice programs. And so I was wondering if you have any insight into, how we can expand the education to physicians and use more encouragement to do those things that and provide this service to families in a better way, than 7 days out.
Yeah, I thanks for the comment. I agree completely. I think it's a broad swath of the medical profession behaves in various ways. I have some confidence that younger doctors who get palliative care education in medical school and throughout their training are going to be more comfortable with these sorts of decisions. And I couldn't agree more that too often hospice and palliative care get referrals late in the game. And that's a shame, because there's so much more that can be offered. I think it's in our society to some degree. I think to some extent doctors and patients reflect our denial of death culture in this country, which I think exists, that, we're going to be really, really aggressive and do everything until we finally realize there's nothing else to be done, and then there's only a few more days to live. So I think it's a cultural thing to some extent, and both patients and doctors, to some degree, I think, have bought into this. So I think it's these sorts of discussions, better education for doctors and patients in general about what these sorts of interventions have to offer, which I think are great. And then I think absolutely trying to get people to understand things like palliative care doesn't mean you're giving up. It doesn't mean you're not doing certain types of treatment. It's just a different philosophy about medicine and life that we'd like to introduce into the equation early on. So I couldn't support your ideas more.
Well, even the terminology that we use, and it's understandable, right? It sounds very empowering to talk about battling a very serious illness, but it sounds like capitulation if somehow we've decided that we're not going to fight that battle in the same way.
Absolutely. And one of my books was called The Breast Cancer Wars, so I talked about that exact use of metaphors. And to some degree, the metaphors are there for a reason. A lot of cancer patients, some that I know, some are my patients, love to say they're fighting their cancer, but potentially on the other side, and certainly when things don't go as well, we tend to think, unfortunately, that if you're not, quote, doing everything and trying your hardest, you're somehow failing. And I can't reiterate enough how that gets to be a bad situation, and people really shouldn't think that. And to the degree that we can point that out early on and understand how it's good to be aggressive early on, but if things are not going in the right direction, it's also okay to ease up a little bit. That's very important.
My guest is Baron H. Lerner, an internist, historian of medicine, and bioethicist. His newest book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. We'll take more of your calls and emails after this. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. And you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with bioethicist, medical historian, and internist Baron H. Lerner, author of the new book, The Good Doctor, A Father, a Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One thing your father seemed willing to do for his patients, whether this is ultimately the right thing or the wrong thing, was to make choices for them. Now it seems very, very strange to us to hear about a doctor basically saying, I know what's right and we'll do it this way, and not giving the patient any choices. On the other hand, so many times people who have a really serious medical crisis are wishing that somebody would just say, here's the right thing to do, and just come with me and I'll make sure it happens for you.
Yeah, this is true. I guess using the pendulum metaphor might be the most helpful here. My dad trained in an era of paternalism, in which doctors felt entirely comfortable making decisions for patients. Indeed, they thought it was their job and their duty to do that. Doing anything else, like asking a patient their opinion, didn't make any sense. The doctors had the training, they spent time with patients, and they said, this is what I think you should do. But that was seen, that sort of paternalism is exactly what got rejected in the era of bioethics, when appropriately a lot of patients came to their doctors and realized that even though the doctors had been well-meaning, they were telling them to do things that maybe weren't such a good idea or weren't a good idea for them, and doctors actually didn't know everything about everyone. I'm thinking in particular, this happened very commonly in the birthing room where women were giving birth, or women with breast cancer where doctors were telling them to have a certain type of aggressive surgery that wasn't necessary. So there was a backlash. And as a result, in came bioethics and in came what we call patient autonomy. And all of a sudden, patients were the decision makers and families were the decision makers if patients couldn't do it. And I think we're coming back to a point now where we're realizing that we maybe threw the baby out with the bathwater, and not all patients want to make decisions, and not all patients are necessarily able to always make the right decisions. So I think what my dad was arguing for at the end of his career was not going back to the old days of manipulating things and doctors doing everything, but the notion of a doctor who patient could trust giving wise advice. And telling patients that this is what they thought should be done. And I certainly have plenty of patients who ask my advice all the time. What I do is I if I give them the advice, I always give a caveat at least and say, look, don't do this just because I'm the one telling you to do it. Do it because you've thought about the options and you agree with it.
What did you learn about your father beyond the facts and circumstances of cases you might not have heard about? What did you learn about his thought processes and who he was as a person that you might not have had you not read these journals?
Well, I couldn't help in his journals realize a lot of what he was saying in his journals was things he wouldn't say in public mm-hmm. to anyone else. I guess that's not uncommon. But he was a man of his era, so he wasn't prone to outward displays of emotion. I think the number of times I'd seen him cry was a handful at most, even at very sad events. And he put a lot of his emotions into his journals, and he wrote a lot about, for example, when my mother had breast cancer, he very much took charge of the situation and was managing her care and getting her doctors. Meanwhile, in his journals, he was putting all of his emotions into it and saying he was afraid she was going to die and, oh, my God, what will I do after that? And we didn't see, my sister and I certainly didn't see any of that behavior at all outwardly, or my mother, for that matter. He was confiding to his journals his emotions. So I, in a sense, met a different person there, someone who actually was a very emotional person, but I think in part because he was a doctor, was unwilling to display that openly and felt that as a doctor, he always had to be the one in charge and the one not showing emotion.
That's a heavy burden to place on anyone.
It is. I think it's not uncommon among, I think, all of us to some degree who are doctors, certainly at a time of crisis, to try to go into doctor mode and to try to do that for one's loved ones and one's family. I think that the downside is when you don't let your emotions out in other ways. And at least in his case, he let it out in his writing.
How did all of this affect you when your family was looking to you to sort of take charge and make some decisions when your father became too ill to make decisions for himself?
Well, it was, of course, I was already working on the book, so there was a lot of irony there. Here I'd been sort of criticizing my father in print about his decisions and getting over-involved in my grandmother's care, and how could he do that, and he should have known better. And all of a sudden, here he was in the nursing home, as we were saying before, and I was getting all these phone calls, and I needed to discuss with him what we were going to do and what did I think was the right thing. And so there, this is one of those great ironies of life, what goes around comes around. So here I was sitting in that situation that I'd been critical of him. And yet, when push came to shove, in conjunction certainly with the rest of the family, we decided that it would be best, and what my dad really would have wanted was no aggressive care. And we felt that the behavior that he had demonstrated for the vast majority of his life indicated to us that the condition that he was living in was unsatisfactory to him. And if he, again, we use this magical notion of him being able to see himself in the state that he was in with his Parkinson's, and we felt that he would not have wanted, for example, to go back to a hospital or to get aggressive care. And that was ultimately the decision we made. And vis-a-vis the caller before, we put him into hospice. So he was in a nursing home, and he went into the hospice program within the nursing home, which basically meant that if and when he got sick, there was going to be nothing aggressive done, and he would just be made comfortable. And that's eventually what wound up happening. I mean, he was in hospice for many months, but when he got an infection in the nursing home and had some trouble breathing, he was given, ironically, again, morphine, which he had used himself in the case of my grandmother, and eventually stopped breathing and died.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ray in Mesquite. Hello, Ray.
Hello. I really appreciate the call. It's ironic that some of the things that the doctor is saying is exactly what happened in my family. I've got physicians in my family, and I also have friends that are physicians. I've been in the medical industry for over 40 years, and I have seen so many changes in medicine. Ironically, I pulled the plug on my own dad because I work on monitors and I know that a person is not alive. But what happens and what's happening now is the whole industry is turned upside down, starting with the insurance companies that are charging outrageous rates to the doctors, and they're afraid to do anything to get sued. The main thing about it is the groups are being bought out, doctors are being bought out, all by foreign interests. Hospitals are being bought out by foreign interests, and it's all the bottom line.
Do you think that's right? Do you think money's at the heart of some of these changes, Barron?
I think that you've got to pay attention to the changes in medicine, the money issues, the organizational issues, the insurance companies. It makes it very hard. I mean, some of what I'm talking about in the book about ways in which we can get back to the sort of medicine my dad practiced is extraordinarily difficult because doctors don't work like they used to. I mean, as the caller was saying, the hospitals have become bureaucratized. So there's lots of forms to be filled out. You have insurance companies dictating what they will and won't pay for. So it's very hard, if anything, to build up long-term relationships that let a doctor and patient know what's going on. You know, I think one of the things that's good to do is to try, and this has been done with some success, is to try to build into the existing bureaucratic structure opportunities to have meaningful discussions. And one of the ones, unfortunately, that fell by the wayside was the effort in the healthcare reform to get doctors to get paid to have an end-of-life discussion. Mm-hmm. That was sort of derided as death panels,
right,
and went away. But that's the sort of thing, if there's a reality of a bureaucracy, at least if you can build that in to the time frame and get these discussions to take place, at least then within a complicated bureaucratic system, we can try to do the right thing.
Talk about this line between, I mean, on the one hand, doctors are simply stretched for time and they really don't have maybe adequate time to spend with patients to get to know them. On the other hand, doctors are also encouraged now to have sort of a professional distance that maybe they weren't, it wasn't stressed quite so much when your father was first practicing medicine.
Yeah, there's I mean, we talk a lot these days about, again, conflict of interest, and to some degree, you know, I think that as ethicists have come into the world of medicine, part of the reaction here has been against doctors who have gotten too close to patients, become friends with patients. For example, one of the issues we talk about with the young medical residents these days is, should they be Facebook friends with their patients, mm-hmm. right? There's all sorts of complicated issues that arise. And again, I think they're good discussions to have because you can, I think, get too engrossed in patients' lives, as my dad did. But what we're losing there is a warmth and a connection, I think, that doctors used to have with patients. And I, you know, in my own practice, I just do what I can. For example, one thing I do in my dad's spirit is to try to, even in a short visit, I try to allot a few minutes to talk about something that's strictly non-medical. And I say, you know what? We're going to talk about your asthma again next time, but tell me about your kids and what's going on in your life, and tell me this. And the things I learn are so valuable, and I might come back to them years or months or years later when my own patient is ill and recall a conversation that we'd had about someone in their family who was sick. So I think there are ways to do it. It's just a challenge.
I guess what you have to do is convince more doctors that there is ultimately some practical value to that in addition to just making you a decent human being.
Yeah, I think all doctors who see patients for 15-minute blocks wish we had 30-minute blocks.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can be frustrating because there's a lot of paperwork. I find on some days when I have so many patients scheduled and I'm really stressed out, I don't do as good a job as I can of trying to connect to my patients. I'm just like, I got to get through this, and it's a bad feeling. I don't really like it at all. But then there are days when it's not quite so bad, and I get a little bit of time, and I get to be the good doctor that I really hope I could be. So I think part of it is looking for your opportunities and trying to not get too frustrated with the way the system is now.
Has the experience of writing this book and thinking about all these issues, about trying to understand your father's perspective and taking a fresh look at your own, has it changed the way that you consume medical care when you need it?
I think I scrutinize other doctors more now. I try not to be too too intrusive, I guess, or that's not really the word, too judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
But one can't help but write a book like this and learn about not only my dad, but doctors of his generation and his mentors, and see how they practice medicine, and then have an eye out for the different things that doctors are doing on a day-to-day basis. And again, I'm not doing it, I don't think, to judge them so much, but to see who does a good job and who doesn't do such a good job, and to try to understand ways that I can use little tips in my own practice. And I certainly appreciate as a patient, and I think when other people in my family are patients, the doctor that does take a little bit of extra time to try to say at least a little, to connect in a personal way a little bit. I think that doctors who are just technicians and you feel that all they're doing is thinking about the next patient and getting out at the end of the day, I think you can tell that, and it makes me uncomfortable as a patient. And not that I won't go back to them if they're a good doctor for me, but it does say to me a little bit, it's unfortunate that they may have lost some of what they originally went into medicine to do because of the circumstances.
Baron H. Lerner is a bioethicist, historian of medicine, and internist. His latest book is called The Good Doctor, A Father, A Son, and the Evolution of Medical Ethics. Baron, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.